Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Sadot Group of Steward Partners Semiannual Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing star and two. Please note this call may be recorded, and I will be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Casey Snyder. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Raisa, and welcome, everyone. Casey Snyder and Tom Sadorek here, and we thank you for making time for this afternoon's The Sadorek Group's regularly scheduled semiannual conference call.
Hello, everybody.
Today's,
glad to see you today.
Today's format will be a bit different than calls past. But typically, we look back and discuss the last 6 to 12 months, then focus on current themes, and conclude with some actionable planning or investment-related ideas. Instead, today will be a conversation between Tom and myself as we attempt to address the 5 most frequently asked questions that we've received within the past few months. Then we will discuss 3 questions that are not asked on a regular basis, but we feel may be helpful as we look ahead. And then finally, we'll conclude with more of a philosophical exercise that we may bring up during our meetings this year in attempt to help everyone plan for and continue with their own success. And lastly, and as always, we will leave time for Q&A. Also, we will be posting a slide deck of the themes discussed today, knowing that visuals are often helpful when it comes to digesting financially related subjects. And once the slide deck is live, we will be emailing it to everyone for you to digest and share at your leisure. And with that, let us begin by quickly stating the 5 most frequently asked questions over the past few months for us to begin our conversation. First, are we headed into a recession and what does it mean for me? Second, are we likely to experience more volatility and if so, what's the plan? Third, is this inflationary phase temporary or more the new norm? Fourth, how may I help my kids or those I care about prepare for their future in this environment? And then fifth and lastly, what can I do to forestall the impact of rising healthcare costs, including the cost of in-home or residential care if I need it? And with that, Tom, let's begin with question number 1, and it is a question that comes up in almost every single meeting lately, and that is, are we heading into a recession and what might it mean for me?
Thanks, Casey, and welcome all of you again. Thank you very much for being here. Recessions are interesting. They're something you don't forecast ahead of time. Many people are trying to, but they're really not known until after the fact, until you've got a couple quarters of real data that says, yes, the economy's contracted. What I think is probably most important conceptually for you to grasp is that many of the recessions that we experienced in the last couple decades, the ones that I'm most familiar with and many of you are most familiar with, have been relatively short-lived. Even the 2008-2009 financial crisis was relatively short-lived. It was pretty much a V-shaped recovery, or other recoveries have been kind of U-shaped. What we haven't really experienced in recent past is more of an L-shaped type recovery, similar to what happened in the 1970s. And if you've listened to us over the past few months, we've been trying to tee up your understanding of what an L-shaped recovery might be and how it might feel in terms of a more protracted and delayed recession. I hope that helps you all as you prepare for the future.
Yeah, Tom, and I think about 2 things right now when I think about the potential for a recession. And the first is that it's something what you just mentioned is this seems to be the most anticipated recession ever seen. And consumer sentiment hit an all-time low in 2022 with records dating back to 1971. And what's so unique about this reading is that typically miserable sentiment is associated with being amidst a recession. And we're not in one yet, or maybe we are, but only with the benefit of hindsight. But it just goes to show how many people are almost projecting this recession to be. The second thing I think about when I think about whether or not we experience a recession is how markets tend to perform. And I think about bear markets associated with recessions versus bear markets not associated with the recession. And as a reminder, bear markets are when an index falls by 20% or more for a prolonged period of time. Now, bear markets associated with the recession tend to be deeper and longer, and the downturn tends to fall around 39% on average and lasts around 390 days, compared to non-recessionary bear markets that fall around 26% and last around 202 days. And we sent these charts actually to everyone via email in October to mentally prepare you for the possibility of a recession. And they are again within the slide deck that we will be distributing. But Tom, that kind of brings us back to the question of, are we heading into a recession?
And once again, I have to say we don't know. We won't really know till after the fact. What we do know for certain, however, is the fact that we look at clients and how they've adapted in other recessionary environments. And what we've seen consistently, particularly those of you that really do engage us fully and understand the importance of the planning process, is you become incredibly adaptive. You've been very cognizant of your cash flows, your spending, your savings if you're in the accumulation phase. You've shown incredible resilience throughout prior recessionary periods, including to 08 and 09. And what we most appreciate is that you're aware and you're prudent in your expenses and how you dispense your income in your retirement years, particularly as it relates to tax efficiency, which we'll touch on a little bit more. So we're proud of all of you because you've been incredibly adaptive throughout many, many environments.
Well said, Tom. And let's move into the second question now, and that is, are we going to experience more volatility? And if so, what is the plan? And before I pass it over to you, Tom, I want to provide just some brief context, because on a rolling three-year period, equity volatility has now exceeded what investors experienced during and immediately following the 08-09 financial crisis. You think about it, 2020 was the year of the pandemic, followed by an exuberant rally in 2021, and then a uniform decline across nearly all markets in 2022. So on that happy note, Tom, are we going to experience more volatility? And again, if so, what's the plan?
So, Casey, you touched on something that I think is really important. Coming into 2022, we had actually had a period of incredibly benign markets. 2021 was an anomaly, that there was absolutely no volatility whatsoever. The market just marched straight up. And that's why we cautioned coming into last year that market valuations were exceedingly rich, and that we were concerned, quite frankly. And what we know going forward is that volatility is part of the norm. We should adapt to it and prepare for it and know that it's going to continue. And 2022 was certainly an anomaly from the standpoint that the sell-off was both in equities, particularly the growth sector of equities, and the fixed income market. And what happened in the fixed income market was historic and, quite frankly, pretty devastating for a lot of folks that weren't prepared. So we saw the worst bond market in pretty much in history. But you've all recovered, and all, quite frankly, if you look back and look at the whole year in total, it wasn't that bad given how bad things really were in the market. So we're quite pleased with how our clients have held up, and this is a very similar story to what we said in 2008 and 2009, where our returns were incredibly strong given how bad the markets really were. So that's our feeling, and just I think the thing you need to really put in context is that 2021 was unusual. 2022 was equally unusual from a different angle.
So to that point, Tom, if volatility is the norm, I think we should differentiate strategies or general plans based on stage of life. So given how the opportunity set today is different than a year ago, what might be a general plan for retirees when it comes to preserving capital, preserving purchasing power, and really just general comforts?
Great question. And we've talked about the silver linings of the recession with many of our private meetings with clients in the last few months. And more broadly to those of you that have not met with us recently, this fact that the bond market sold off so dramatically, what basically was supposed to happen in a 3 or 4 year period happened in 3 or 4 months or 8 months, that provided opportunities. So you've seen for the first time in a very, very long time, very attractive returns, you know, I'm talking about income yields, on fixed income. That had not been the case for the better part of the last decade. So you mentioned opportunity sets, Casey. Bonds are incredibly attractive. Equities may still be a little overpriced and may, in fact, fall off a little bit. But the fact is that if we look at a balanced account now going forward, and there's a lot more of this in the media as well, that fixed income may provide some enormous surprises in years ahead. And Casey, so think about the folks that you're often talking to, many of your peers. What are folks in their saving years thinking about, and how are you trying to help them think about the accumulation phase as opposed to the distribution phase, as many of my clients are thinking about?
Yeah, so I think it's important for accumulators, anyone who's in savings mode, to recognize that lower starting valuations make for more attractive entry points into stock and bond markets, and a recession may actually create a great opportunity. And I recognize that that may not be a popular opinion, but recessions often mark the birth of the next bull market, and it's often the origin of significant wealth creation. There's also another point here in that everyone on this call has heard us harp on the importance of tax efficiency. And for accumulators, the creation of future tax flexibility alongside tax-smart investment strategies is critical. So without knowing where tax rates may be 10, 20, or 30 years from now, savers need to create the ability to draw from different types of accounts when they're older. And one of the best ways of creating this type of flexibility is by strategically saving between Roth, pre-tax, and after-tax accounts throughout their career. That then transcends into the tax-efficient and dynamic distribution strategies that also then go to help preserve the purchasing power and capital when you move into that distribution phase. Tom, I want to move into question three now, and it's kind of changing gears a little bit, but this has been a subject of conversation for the better part of the year. And question three here is, and in so many words, is this inflationary phase temporary or likely to be protracted?
So once again, similar to trying to analyze recessions, you don't really know till after the fact as to how bad this phase may or may not be in terms of inflation. Well, there are certainly some signs that it is starting to abate, and that's encouraging. However, there are also some demographic challenges facing the economy, and this is on a global basis. Is that the number of workers are leaving the workforce, and that therefore wages, which are one of the components of inflation, may continue to rise as productivity is not growing at a rate that could make up for that. So in other words, despite the fact that inflation, commodities, and things that we buy and use are going down, some of the input costs, like labor, may continue to rise. So as much as inflation was a serious concern for the better part of a decade, right now it looks like it may be a relatively small concern, but may be more protracted going forward. Casey, I know you're in the process of rebuilding your home after tragic fire back in the spring, and we're excited to hear about the advancements. And I think you've learned something about inflation, which is that supply chains have a way of correcting themselves. I think probably if you looked a year and a half ago and you were going to be pricing the lumber for your home, it had to be pretty scary. And all of a sudden now, because things have normalized somewhat, the input costs for your home have actually moderated somewhat. Isn't that right?
It is, and it is very much appreciated. I'm very happy that supply-demand imbalance has worked itself through a little bit. Tom, there's also another, I think, part of this conversation, and it's, you know, we often reference, and you often reference, the Volcker era. And there's been a lot of comparisons to the late 70s, early 80s because of inflation being what it was. But would you mind speaking a bit about some of the similarities and differences of that era versus where we are today?
Absolutely. And this is a very important difference, distinction from what happened in the early 80s to what's happening now. And we just did an op-ed for the New Hampshire Business Review on this very topic, which is the difference between the environment, the political and policy environment today versus what Mr. Volcker was dealing with back in the 80s. In the 1980s, Mr. Volcker was doing exactly what he needed to do, which was jack interest rates up to try and wring inflation out of the economy. What was different then, though, is that he had great cooperation from the fiscal side, from people like Warren Rudman, our late senator, and you might remember Graham Rudman Hollings, which was a bill that was designed to limit the growth of government back in the 1980s. Unfortunately, today, Mr. Powell is doing his job at the Fed, but there's not a lot of cooperation out of Congress, and that is a great concern. We don't know how it's going to play out. We hope that maybe cooler heads, and as we said in the op-ed, that we hope adults enter the room. We hope the cooler heads will eventually prevail and they'll get their act together so there can be coordinated efforts between what the Fed is doing with monetary policy and what Congress is doing with fiscal policy.
The question four here, Tom, is one that we are receiving far more frequently today than I would say a year ago. And it is that, how can I help my kids and those I care about prepare for their future in this environment?
So that's a million-dollar question. I think that we posted a piece, I want to say it was a year and a half ago, about expectations of younger investors that they were anticipating or actually predicting that they would get 16% annualized returns. Well, obviously that turned out not to be the case, and we at the time tried to dampen those expectations. All we'll say today is what Casey mentioned earlier, is that the opportunity set for investors now is probably as good, if not better, than it's been in the better part of a decade or decade and a half, where interest rates are higher, so bond yields are actually attractive, equity valuations are considerably cheaper than they were a year ago. So this is a great time for young investors to get started, as long as they don't expect 16% returns. Okay, so start early and manage expectations accordingly. But this is a great opportunity for the younger generation to get their feet wet.
Yeah, and I think it's common for this question about helping kids or loved ones to involve some type of housing transition. And right now, housing dilemmas are tough, and there's just no sugarcoating this one. With high interest rates, inflated prices, and demand still outpacing supply, outside of a sharp decline or deep recession, these imbalances may continue for a while. And having spent some time in the mortgage industry early in my career, I find that people often get caught up in the purchase price instead of focusing on the debt-to-income ratios and the carrying costs of a home, meaning taxes, insurance, maintenance, and upkeep. Debt-to-income ratios are what matter most when it comes to affordability for those that need a mortgage. During the housing meltup in the 2000s, debt-to-income ratios of 40 to 50% were permissible and even encouraged, rather than the 15 to 25% range, which is far more appropriate because of how it provides room for the other expenditures in one's life, such as savings or vacations, emergency money, and frankly, just room for error. This is a subject, actually, that we covered, I believe, in episode 3 of Beyond Your Balance Sheet last spring because of the emotional spring housing market being what it was. So it's a big deal. There's no easy solution to this one, but focus on debt-to-income ratios and carrying costs. And, Tom, that's going to bring us to our fifth question, the fifth and final question that we've received most over the last couple of months, and it's one that we discussed on a regular basis, almost daily. And it's, whether it be about one's aging parents or with retirees who are planning ahead. And the question is, what can I do to forestall the impact of rising healthcare costs, including the cost of in-home or residential care if needed?
So, folks, once again, when it comes to aging, Casey always kind of picks on me, but I do have a little bit of experience in this one, and I will say that the very simple answer to the challenge with rising healthcare costs is have a plan. And we don't care what that plan is, whether it means aging in place, considering a community, having your kids move in with you, whatever it is, we just know that those that have a plan and therefore we can stress test your plan as to how it adapts to these changes in costs, particularly as it relates to healthcare, then you're going to be in good shape. If you bury your head in the sand and don't have a plan and choose to use denial as your plan, that's going to be a challenge for us and for you in the years ahead. So think about some of the options. I'm sorry, Casey. Let me finish one thought. Think about some of the other options out there as you explore your choices and as you explore your options with your family. Sorry, Casey.
No worries. Sorry about that. I was going to say, I often think about this from the perspective of wanting to avoid the fire drill and the importance about being proactive, which is something that you just mentioned. And I've seen it in my own life with loved ones, and unfortunately we see it all the time, but it's how a fire drill can take someone out of their role as a loving spouse, son or daughter, and suddenly thrust them into the role of caretaker or needing to become an at-home healthcare expert or an insurance expert. And I think the best approach, and to your point, Tom, it doesn't matter what it is, but having a plan, and that plan often means preparing for the worst and hoping for the best, knowing that this can be an emotional stage of life. And being proactive is a meaningful gift to loved ones. And by being proactive, it preserves one's role as the loving spouse, son, or daughter.
And I think many of you have heard me say over the years that one of the greatest gifts given to the Sidorek family was when my folks chose to explore CCRC. At the time they did it, I didn't even know what a CCRC was. Now I'm more than well-versed on what CCRCs are. The acronym, again, is Continuing Care Retirement Community. But whether it be a CCRC for you or family, helping you navigate the aging process, or agencies or outside support, whatever it is, we just beg you, have a plan, think about what your alternatives are, and do some research early. Not a fire drill, as Casey said. We want to avoid those at all costs whenever possible.
Well said, Tom. And that brings us to the end of the five most frequently asked questions. We're going to change gears now to discuss three questions that have not been regularly asked, but may be helpful as we look ahead. And the first question here is, what's the role of dividends within a portfolio, and why is this important? And dividends are often an underappreciated component of annual returns and total returns over time. And as Tom previously mentioned, you know, the starting early and the basic power of compounding is real. And it's why Albert Einstein famously referred to it as the eighth wonder of the world. Since 1940, a little context here, since 1940, dividends have accounted for 38% of the S&P 500's total return. And during various decades, dividends have been responsible for the majority of total returns. So for example, they made up about 66% of total return in the 1940s, 72% of total returns in the 1970s, and frankly, they helped break even in the 2000s. If we go back further, so if we go back to 1928, when you factor in reinvested dividends, the annual return increases from 5.8% to 9.9%, and total returns jump from 21,500 to more than 750,000%. Now, I'm not suggesting that we all have 94 years in front of us and that history will repeat itself, because it won't, but whether you be in your accumulation years or in retirement, dividends and growing dividends and the reinvestment of dividends is a powerful strategy to help keep pace with and outperform inflation, especially if we move through a horizontal decade or an L-shaped recovery, as Tom mentioned earlier in this call. So the second question that is just starting to come up now, early stages here, is that, do I need to know anything about the SECURE Act 2.0? The short answer to this is yes and no. You don't need to know the details. That's for your accountant and for us to help you with. But you do need to know that there were nearly 100 rule changes regarding retirement planning put into place at the end of 2022, effective immediately. And this massive piece of legislation will impact retirement plans, IRAs, 529s, distribution, tax, and estate planning strategies. And again, while you do not need to know the ins and outs of the SECURE Act 2.0, your accountant does.
And it further underscores something that we've talked about a great deal in the past, which is the importance of tax counsel in your lives. We know the value of good tax counsel in the accounting profession. It continues to be underloved. Many of you may not be aware of a story that ran the tail end of last year, December 28th to be exact, in the Wall Street Journal, but it was a significant story written about the significant migration and retirement of accounting professionals. They're leaving in droves, and as a result, those of us that need good tax counsel and need to be able to collaborate with your tax counsel, they're leaving the profession, and that is a serious concern. It means that you need to treat your accountants with the greatest of respect whenever possible. Understand that they're under enormous stress and have been for the better part of 4 years because of the pandemic and all the rule changes that are occurring. And now the Secure Act, once again, at the 12th month of the year, 100 different rule changes that they all have to adapt for and help you and help us help you with. So this is significant, and if you don't appreciate your accountant, please do give them hugs, send them flowers, and just say thank you whenever possible.
Well said. All right, Tom, the third and last question here that we're starting to receive with a bit more frequency, and we think it's an important one, is how might the dysfunctional political environment and fractured Congress impact markets this year?
So we touched on this a little bit earlier, and I won't go into great detail, but there's a very different environment today versus back in the 70s, where there was collaboration, cooperation. We anticipate as this debt ceiling debate continues that there will be market volatility. You might recall that a number of years ago when there was, a debate over the debt ceiling, that one of the rating agencies actually dropped the rating on U.S. government debt from AAA to, I think, AA+, or AAA-, I can't remember, but it was a drop, and it was significant because what that means is that our borrowing costs go up. So if, in fact, Congress can't get its act together and the battle rages on, I could see that another rating agency is going to say that the federal government can't get their act together and our bonds will be downgraded once again and our borrowing costs will go up, which only means that we're passing on additional obligations to future generations.
Well, on that happy note, Tom, that concludes our three questions that have not been regularly asked but may be helpful as we look ahead. And lastly, we are going to conclude with more of a philosophical exercise, and we feel like it's an important one. And the question, or the rhetorical question, that we want you to ask yourselves is, how has my life changed over the past 5 to 10 years, and how may it change over the next 5 to 10 years? And this is a question we're going to ask many of you this year to help you prepare and navigate your own opportunities and realities in the years to come. One of the few certainties in life is change, and when we think about the past 10 years and the path that brought us to where we are today, it's usually a path that no one could have predicted. Therefore, it's fair to assume that the next 10 years will involve a great deal of change, maybe more, maybe less, and the path in getting there will be equally as unpredictable. We all understand this conceptually, yet many of us struggle with the reality of this statement. And as your fiduciaries, it's our responsibility to look around corners on your behalf and help you make the most of your time, which is the most important commodity on the planet that can never be replenished. So we ask that you consider, within reason, how your life may change and how your decisions and actions today or this year may impact your life 3 to 5 years from now. And as you reflect on this exercise, we welcome a conversation if there's anything that you want to talk through, that you want to contemplate, or if you'd like us to model within your plan, or just make sure that it's already accounted for. So with that, Tom, that's going to bring us to the conclusion of our February 2023 update. We will open it up for Q&A in just a moment, but before we do, we want to express our sincere appreciation for your ongoing trust and engagement We relish our responsibilities here and look forward to helping all of you navigate whatever may lie ahead. So with that, we'll open up the line for Q&A and ask that people identify themselves using only their first name. Thank you.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. You may remove yourself from the queue by pressing star and two. Once again, to ask a question, please press star and one. And we'll take our first question from Don. Your line is open.
Hello. Thank you for that review. It's always appreciated. I've been watching with great interest the evolution of artificial intelligence in our lives. And I think we may have reached a little tipping point with the ChatGPT program that's been all over the news. So it led me to actually create a poem about the Sidorit conference call today. So that led me to wonder, what do you see as the role of artificial intelligence and robotic investing in your lives, in your work as a fiduciary? Is it helpful? Do you think it's going to be a real game changer, or is it kind of just a small tool in a repertoire of skills that you already have?
Well, so thank you for the question, Don. Do we get to hear the poem later, or are you holding us in suspense?
Well, I'm not totally sure of the R rating for this group, so I'm not going to share it right now, but I will
Understood.
Send it to you.
Okay. We appreciate it very much. So to answer your question, it is very interesting that you asked this, because we certainly know that AI is becoming an issue. But the fact of the matter is that technology has been invading the markets for the better part of the last three or four decades. I have a letter that I cherish. I wrote to then Senator Rudman about after the 1987 financial collapse. And those of you may remember what happened was that the market sold out by almost 30-40%, and nobody understood why. It happened over a period of roughly 2 days. And it was significant. And at the time, it was called portfolio insurance. And basically what that was is algorithms in the background that got it wrong and triggered a bunch of sell orders happening all at once that drove the market down that dramatically. So technology has been in the markets for decades now. What I think is different about AI now is what you said, Don, which is some of the content, meaning some of the analytics, some of the analysis that's being done. We don't know whether something's been written by a human being with a PhD from XYZ or some bot or some algorithm that's writing it for us. But as long as the content's still valuable, do we really care who the writer was? Does it change the quality of it? Does it change the integrity of that work? And I would say probably not. And in many respects, we may find that some of the AI work is actually better than what humans can do, because we're obviously fraught with emotions. And so far, computers don't do a great job of human emotions. They're getting better, mind you, but they're not quite there yet. So I think technology has been invading the markets for a long, long time. And I think much of what you're asking about is really relating to the analytics, the content. And I think that it may be quite beneficial, quite frankly, going forward. Casey, do you have anything you might add?
It always makes me think of, and I'm going to throw out a name here because she spoke at a conference, Faith Popcorn in 2016 is a futuristic trend forecaster. And she spoke in 2016 at the Barron's Top Team Conference to some of the most successful and recognized teams in our profession about how the world was going to change over the next 10 to 15 years. And AI was at the core of it. And there's a lot of good, I would say, that can come with it, to Tom's point, but it also is fraught with anxieties, with potholes, and with a lot of things that I think investors, savers, everyone needs to kind of come to terms with. So very interesting. Very exciting, but also kind of call it cautiously optimistic.
And one footnote to this. So next time you hear that the market sold off 3,000 points and everybody's running around and all the talking heads around the media saying, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, I'll pretty much bet or guarantee you that it was some technological glitch in the background that caused it to happen. I can't, you know, forecast when that may or may not happen, but I'll bet you it's going to be some sort of technological glitch that caused it to happen, because there have been glitches in the markets. You may have read about liquidity issues a couple weeks ago, as a matter of fact. So, you know, it's not perfect, but there are things in place to kind of moderate and guardrails to help make sure that the damage is not devastating. Sorry for the long answer, Don. Wait for the poem, though. Next question. And star one if you have a question, please.
And that is star and one if you'd like to ask a question. We will pause for a moment and allow further questions to queue.
Casey, we might get off easy today. Who knows?
And it appears we have no further questions at this time.
Okay.
Well, folks, we're grateful for your attendance today. I'll let Casey close this out, but we're grateful that you took time out of your day for us. We're grateful for your trust and ongoing collaboration. So thank you, Casey.
Oh, I think you just said it all. So we really appreciate your time. If you do have any other questions, let us know. Schedule some time. Give us a call. We try to make ourselves always available. And otherwise, enjoy the rest of your afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you.